Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. It is November 1963. We are doing part two of this Beatles month. They're in the middle of a big tour. They've been doing great work. It is the 16th of November and they've moved from Bristol the previous night to the Winter Gardens in Bournemouth. A busy time. And again, this thing of the US paying attention is very true in Bournemouth.
The US are starting to pay attention to the extent that there are three camera crews from ABC, CBS and NBC all there to film parts of the concert at the Winter Garden Theatre.
And there's also a brief John and Paul interview for CBS. There's also this possibility that they could be in Life magazine.
This is such a strange thing. So there's a photographer from Life magazine, Terence Spencer. So he and his assistant were invited to the hotel, Branksome Towers. Perhaps people can tell us if it's still there. where the Beatles were staying. But the Beatles don't turn up for the photo shoot. So effectively they turn down what would have been the 13th of January 1964 cover of Life magazine. Life magazine is a big thing.
Mm.
And Spencer later remarked that they must have been the only people in show business ever to have turned down a Life cover. Now, I checked, and their first appearance on the cover was then not until August the 28th, 1964. So,
I do wonder how true that story is. Were they really in line for getting it? Like, it could have just been a Life magazine story.
Could have been.
You know, and maybe when they saw which way the wind was blowing in January 64, they could have bumped them up to the cover. I'm not totally convinced that somebody was going to randomly put them on the cover of Life magazine. I could be wrong, but
it's always the first time.
Yeah. but anyway, whether it was for the front or for the inside of the magazine, they missed their shot, literally.
Yes.
But the footage that's recorded for the telly appears on the 9th of December 1963 on a thing called Beatleland. A report called Beatleland.
Such a good title.
Great title. And it also gets reused on the Jack Parr Show on the 1st of January, 64. And, you know, they're having a good time in Bournemouth. They go for a post-show meal.
Yeah, Beatles gotta eat.
Beatle gotta eat. I'm always saying that. Did Beatle get to eat, as we also say?
No, the restaurant turns them away, apparently, because the restaurant they were going to was already booked for a private wedding. Now, supposedly what happens is the groom ushers them in. Would you do that? I don't know. And then supposedly the band go back to their hotel, grab some instruments, come back and give a private one-hour party performance for the wedding crew. What?
It
all seems very unlikely.
You'd think, well, would there be a photo? You'd think somebody might have popped out a photo. It's certainly a new story to me. But you'd be very happy to have the Beatles at your wedding.
Very good.
Yeah, but you'd think they'd want to, like, a lie down.
Yeah.
Like, they're busy. It's not like, oh, we'll just do another gig.
Oh, the Beatles. Oh, right.
Yeah. 17th of November, they go to Coventry Theatre, and that's in...
Coventry.
Coventry. And that's in the Midlands.
Yeah.
Okay, my geography's getting better. 18th of November, finally.
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 A day off.
A day off. And what do they do on their day off?
Well, they go to a ceremony at EMI House in London where they're given silver presentation discs to mark their extraordinary record sales.
Mm.
So not really a day off.
No, it's not a day off at all. They're presented with discs for Please Please Me and also for With the Beatles, which curiously is not in the shops yet.
It's advance orders.
That is how they count these things in those days. And Sir Joseph Lockwood is there.
Good old Sir Joe.
Good old Sir Joe. And George Martin is there.
Yeah, good old Sir George.
He wasn't Sir George at the time. But he gives him a disc for marking the sales of the Twist and Shout EP.
I like the fact that it's a smaller disc to reflect the fact that it...
Less music. Yes.
Or a smaller EP disc.
Can we take a moment to talk about how the Beatle EPs have slipped out of the culture? And, you know, if we were to do an episode on the Beatle EPs, just write that down.
Beatle EPs.
I have to admit, I don't have any particular knowledge about the Beatle EPs per se. Like, you know, we all kind of have a set knowledge of the albums or the order they come out or what they look like and all that kind of stuff. But I think that kind of EP knowledge has slipped away. It was very much of its time.
It was of its time. It was, there were no such thing, I think, as an EP in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a UK phenomenon. The idea, I think, is it's a halfway point between the two sides of a 7-inch single and 12, 14 tracks on an LP. So they take the four, usually, most popular songs off an LP, put them on an EP, and then the teenagers and people who don't have enough money to go and buy an LP can buy an EP. Or in the 20th, 21st century, you know, you can buy them as CDs and all sorts of different formats. But yeah, it's a strange phenomenon. And it sort of finishes around 1966. I want to say it's maybe Nowhere Man or somewhere like that. It's kind of fun. But, and then it sort of slightly resurrected for Magical Mystery Tour. Some talk about a Yellow Submarine
EP. That doesn't happen.
In 68. But yeah, it's an odd thing. You can, I mean, I do, I have a couple of them, but I'd never collected the EPs. But there was a Long Tall Sally EP came out and was reissued for Record Store Day a few years ago, and it was a sort of standalone. We talked about this as
we did a Long Tall Sally episode because it's the only original EP. The Long Tall Sally EP is the only original material EP.
You know, I have them on CD, little small 3-inch CDs in a box.
Yeah, and it is to do with cost, you know, because an LP was significantly more expensive than a single, and the point of the EPs would be that they would pull album tracks after the album had come out and then kind of recycle them. So it's almost like a mid-price reissue type thing of the songs. But also, albums did not sell as well as singles.
No, up to this point, generally not. So what you're saying is that Apple should cease all other promotional activity and we should just reissue the EPs. Is that what you're saying? In several different versions of streaming?
Well, I'm sure we would all buy them. But I guess what I'm getting at is there isn't this kind of cultural memory that has lingered about the EPs the way it has with the albums and the singles and a few other bits
and pieces. No, I think the only one, if you call, is the Twist and Shout EP.
Yeah.
And that's probably because of the cover with them sort of jumping up in the air. Because that becomes such a sort of iconic
shot. And even Magical Mystery Tour gets subsumed into the album. But anyway, I digress. But what are we if not our digressions? The Beatles, after their party, they get brought to a formal lunch in the boardroom of EMI House with all the executives and special guests. And I'm sure they had to do a lot of glad handing and shaking hands and all the rest.
They'd have loved that.
Yeah, well, I don't think so. And so that is how they spend their day off. Meanwhile, Mal crashes the car.
Yeah. So he has to take...
You had one job, Mal.
Mal, he had many jobs.
Well, that's true, actually.
Yeah. So Mal is taken to hospital, having crashed the car. And Tony, or as I've written in my notes, Tiny Bramwell, takes over driving duties temporarily. But also on this day, a Church of England vicar asks them to record a song to encourage attendance at church, it seems.
And they get straight to it.
They get, "Oh, come all ye faithful."
It's a bit late in the day.
Yeah.
It's a bit late in the day on the 18th of November to say, chaps, could you do a Christmas song? And they've already got their Christmas fan club messages. It's coming down the pipeline. 19th of November, they're in the Gaumont Cinema in Wolverhampton. That is nearby. That's not a big...
That's the Midlands.
Yes, so they're still close. And then the 20th of November, they're at the ABC Cinema, again in Manchester. And this is a well-documented famous gig.
This is well-documented because Pathé News are there filming them singing She Loves You and Twist and Shout. And there's sort of backstage and crowd scenes. And this is all sort of edited into an 8-minute cinema feature entitled The Beatles Come to Town. And it's shown for a week at Christmas, December 22nd. Only a week. You'd think, you know, this, if you hadn't been one of the lucky 120,000 people to get a ticket, you'd think you would go to the cinema.
But wasn't that the nature of Pathé News, that this is the news?
Yeah.
So the rolling news in this case was just a rolling cinema reel for a week. So they would be doing these features and that's it. You had your week. It wasn't news once the week was over.
I suppose so.
That's the whole point.
Also, and this I find is very interesting, Granada TV, which is the sort of regional
ITV
broadcaster, they interview the Beatles about their forthcoming US tour. So this is on the 20th of November.
But wait, I... Checks notes. They're not at number one yet, Stephen.
Well, I think, again, it must just be, don't put this out if we don't get to number one.
Yes, we're going to go to number one if we get a tour. No, the other way around. And, all the wheels are in motion at
all
this point.
All the wheels are in motion. They are openly talking about the fact that there is an upcoming US tour. Brian is in America sorting all the arrangements out with Ed Sullivan. And the only person that seems not to be aware is Paul McCartney.
What do you mean, not be aware in 2023?
So, but it's interesting that, you know, it's not just, oh, we don't know Mm-hmm. We do know. Mm. It's just that the legend of we wouldn't go until we got a number one has become fact.
And we would point listeners into our I Want to Hold Your Hand episode and our Ed Sullivan Show episodes, which overlap with this time, to give you an idea of exactly what is going on. But the point is that apart from the whole UK phenomenon, they would have been totally within their rights to just sort of sit on their laurels and ride it out big time in the UK. You kind of have to think the ambition here is pretty stunning, that instead of this being their victory lap for 1963, where they're doing this massive tour and they're about to put out a massive album and all the rest, the point is that their manager is abroad and he's actually saying, no, this doesn't stop at Christmas. There's other mountains to climb.
This is totally proactive.
Absolutely.
You know, Brian has a plan and he is working on the plan and it is well in hand. The Beatles are fulfilling the first stage while he is off in America plotting the second leg of that. So it's a very thought out strategy.
And the other thing that happens in Manchester is that there's an important person in the audience.
Mr. Derek Taylor is there.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show, reporting for the Daily Express.
Now, he has already seen them in Manchester in May 1963, so this isn't his first time. And obviously, we have our Derek Taylor episodes that you can all enjoy. So he is there. His wife, Joan, is not there. She is pregnant. She's 8 months pregnant. So he has brought his sister-in-law, Diane, who's only 16 years of age, and so prime Beatle fan candidate.
Yep.
And, you know, I guess you couldn't really bring an eight-month pregnant lady to a gig like that, could you?
You certainly couldn't. He talks about this in 50 Years Adrift, his hard-to-find, very expensive book. And he says specifically, a Beatle concert in that phase of their career was no place for a woman in that phase of pregnancy. So two things I would say.
I know where you're going.
One, she seems to spend a lot of the 60s pregnant. And secondly, this would not have been the riskiest Beatles-related incident involving his pregnant wife ever to occur.
Go listen to our Derek Taylor episodes if you haven't. This is their seventh appearance in total in Manchester. And at this point, it's a press hullabaloo, a media sensation. And, you know, it's, Derek puts this phrase together, which I really like, which is, it is quite simply the ultimate phenomenon of show business. And that's kind of what we're getting at here. They are rewriting show business in their image throughout this kind of month in terms of what makes show business interesting, what, you know, the whole culture of the performer is as interesting as the performance, and how big can showbiz get and how pervasive can it be, almost show business as a lifestyle adjunct.
Yes, and he does say this statement, it was quite simply the ultimate phenomenon of show business, was both grandiose and factual, and he reprints in his book the entire review that he gets, and even the first line, Beatlemania in its sobbing, throbbing extremities gripped Manchester last night. It captivated the teenagers of the city and far beyond. It drew 5,000 of them inside the Apollo Cinema to share the thumping ecstasy of their electronic excitement. It's pure Derek Taylor.
Electronic excitement. And once again, he talks about how it tore half the city's police force, men and women, from normal duties. It totally mobilised the first aid resources of South Lancashire, men and women, even earnest children. And this is something that's going to appear very soon in Parliament as an issue. But he also talks about the lads themselves, that, you know, he names them Ringo, George, Paul and John. But he talks about how this is interesting that they are going in and out of the show. This is part of the day's work as well. And the crowd are paying attention to this.
Yeah. And he talks about the fact that the band themselves trying to regard themselves as everyday Liverpool entertainers. But he also talks about the fact that there's ticket tout outside, and he said the Apollo had dozens, and he said mostly tickets sold by men who were in the same spot 10 years ago when Johnny Ray was the draw, 8 years ago when it was Bill Haley, or this May when it was Cliff Richard. So he's sort of referring there to this turnover, the shelf life, but he's already alluded to the fact that this is something else, this is the ultimate phenomenon. So there's a contrast between that and the fact that, yeah, well, you know, I've been here before, I've seen it, Johnny Ray, Bill Haley, Cliff Richard, etc., etc., etc. This is different.
Yes, and you know, if you're Cliff Richard and you're reading that, you're like, hey, wait, I'm still a thing, haven't I?
Yeah.
And I like his description of the Beatles themselves, dressed as Beatles, looking like Beatles, slid quietly into the cinema in the mid-afternoon. No policeman's uniforms this time. That sort of game can be played only once. So that's referring to when they were hiding and dressed up as policemen. Yeah, so he's as much reporting on the whole phenomenon than the gig itself.
I think that's interesting. This is not a concert review. He's talking about the circus around them. So a battery of cameramen which would frighten Khrushchev. Tier on tier of flashbulbs flashed, newsreel cameras whirred, television cameras gently hummed. It was all Christian names. Look this way, George. John, pull Ringo's hair. Fall off a chair, Ringo. Ringo falls. So he's not describing the gig. He's just describing the circus that accompanies them.
And he does describe Lennon as the blandest Beatle of them all, which is a bit of an odd sentence. I don't know what he means there.
I think he means he's the one that's not performing.
Mm.
You know, that everyone else, Ringo, Paul, George, they're maybe going along. Lennon is sort of more sardonic about the whole thing.
And he does talk about this fact that, you know, they're about to be mentioned in Parliament because there's MPs who are concerned about the amount of police protection and the associated cost. And George, classic George, says, you know, we don't cause the hysteria. We just arrive, sing and play and go, said George. The fans do the rest. We love them. But, you know, it's not George's fault that everyone's just going crazy.
No, it's not their fault.
Hmm.
And he said, yeah, the stalls were like a nightmare march fair. No one could remain seated, clutching at each other, hurling jelly babies at the stage, beating their brows. The youth of Britain's second city surrendered themselves totally.
Yes, and again, that phrase again, the ultimate phenomenon of show business. It's present and it's future. And, you know, this is Derek's big break to the Beatles, even though he's seen them before. Did I say big break?
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So the Beatles have taken the world by storm. They've been seen by Derek Taylor in Manchester. Where do we go from Manchester?
Carlisle.
21st November. That's not far away. And this is the day when they do get mentioned in Parliament about the cost of policing their shows. And there isn't really, it's kind of just showboating. There isn't really any big law or decision made.
No, it's just raised in Parliament and there's a bit of a chat. But the idea or the notion is these entertainers are pulling police away from their regular duties. The public purse is paying for protection. And George, you know, we said he made the point, well, you know, it's not us, we just turn up. The fans are there. But it has to be paid for. And it is increasingly, Beatlemania is on the front pages because of the fans, the crowds, the reaction, the hysteria.
But the other thing that's interesting about this is that it puts the Beatles on official Parliament record, the record that's been
Hansard,
kept.
Yes.
Yes, that's been kept for hundreds of years. The Beatles are now being transcribed into parliamentary lore for the ages.
Yes.
You know?
Excellent. So you think thousands of years from now, people are going, what are these?
Well, and the space children of 2000 are smoking their cigars, reading their old copies of Hanson, they'll be able to know what's going on. That's the 21st of November in Carlisle. The next day is November the 22nd. And this is quite a day, but not for Beatle reasons.
Not for Beatle reasons. Not just for Beatle reasons. This is the day that President Kennedy is shot in Dallas.
Yes. Now, the Beatles have an alibi.
They do. Mm-hmm. They have an alibi. They were playing the 18th date of their tour at the Globe Cinema in Stockton-on-Tees.
And the... this does dovetail into the Beatles story because they are on, they're mentioned on CBS News in the morning. There's an article about them in the States on the news.
Yes, so CBS Morning News carries an item about them, which was due to be reshown in the evening, but, you know, Dallas.
Yes.
So they get sort of bumped from the news reports.
So, you know, it's one of those interesting what ifs. There was a primetime news report ready to go, but the story that comes in from Dallas just takes over the airways for the rest of the day. And obviously due to the time difference, the Beatles don't know any of this on the day itself.
No. But this is also the day on which With the Beatles is released.
So in terms of history coming together, you know, the 23rd of November is a very different date to the 21st of November because of what happens in between. So we have With the Beatles coming out. And it's quite... reasonable to say that this was a highly anticipated record?
Highly anticipated. So it has advance orders in the UK of 300,000. quickly sells more than 500,000. By September 65, it sold over 1 million in the UK. It is greeted by the press. NME writes, a great album with a variety of tempo. Variety of tempo.
Variety of tempo? Is that good Latin?
I don't think so. A variety of tempo. Yes, it's a variety. So I think that is correct.
Okay, well
done.
That
is correct. And a raw style that puts the Beatles unmistakably at the top of the tree. You just don't get music journalism like that these days.
Yes, it has advance orders of 300,000 copies and it quickly sells more than 500,000 copies. The album it replaces at number one is?
Please Please Me.
So Please Please Me has been number one for 30 weeks. It is displaced by With the Beatles, which is going to stay at number one for 21 weeks. And that really affects my OCD that that's 51 weeks. It's not 52 weeks.
52.
That really is difficult for me to handle. That just couldn't.
Okay.
The Beatles couldn't have been number one for an entire year. But
how do you feel about the fact that it the album peaked at number 11 on the singles charts?
I just can't handle this kind of thing. But that's, you know, we alluded to a few minutes ago that singles were the number one sellers, albums were not sellers, and the singles chart was actually a representation of all discs of
yes.
all sorts. And the original album charts only existed because albums sold so little they didn't make the singles charts, so you had to create the album charts.
Yeah.
So yes, it is funny that With the Beatles, the album gets to number 11 on the singles chart, but it also goes to show a couple of things. First of all, how much money they are generating.
Yes.
Because, as we said, albums are not cheap and they are selling hundreds of thousands of albums. We said in our Please Please Me episode that the Beatles were an albums band straight out of the box.
Yeah.
And so Please Please Me has been number one for 30 weeks. It is a great album. There's no filler on that album and people have a high expectation. So there's loads of episodes across this month where there's a little bit more petrol put in the fire, as we said at the start. There's the tour itself, there's the Royal Variety performance, and now they are dropping this, they didn't say dropping at the time, but they are dropping this album, which is as good as the debut that people are dying to hear. And yeah, it's value for money.
It's value for money, and it's a perfect marketing strategy. There's a tour, there's a big TV performance, there's a single, there's an album. And again, this is an album without a single.
Correct. And we'll come to the single in a moment because the single itself isn't just out for another couple of days. But yes, and you kind of look at that and think, well, that didn't happen by accident.
All of this is very carefully stage managed. And you've got Brian with his sort of overarching strategy, but then you also have a team around them. You know, Derek Taylor is coming into the mix. But Tony Barrow, Tiny Barrow, I think I'll always think of him.
From now on, his name is Tiny Barrow.
Tony Barrow is effectively their press officer. He's doing the press releases. He has a degree of involvement in the strategy, and he writes the sleeve notes, which I prefer Derek's sleeve notes. Tony Barrow's sleeve notes are good, they're a little bit kind of factual. They're less emotive than Derek's.
Well, where does Tony go? He's like, it starts with like 14 tracks are recorded, isn't it? It's very factual.
It's very factual. 14 freshly recorded titles, including many surefire stage show favourites, are featured on the two generously filled sides of this record. I mean, it's more in the nature of a press release, I think.
Yeah.
The thing that I find odd is the next sentence where he said, the Beatles have repeated the successful formula which made their first Please Please Me LP into the fastest selling album of 1963. I mean, he's explicitly saying, oh, well, we've just done the same as we did before.
But that wasn't seen. The Beatles haven't yet invented the idea that people have to progress from one album onto the next.
I suppose
it's basically saying, oh, you like that thing? Then this is the thing again.
Here's more of the same.
Yeah. But he talks about, they have 8 of their own original compositions alongside a batch of personal choice pieces. I don't know whether that was an intentional number that was designed to match Please Please Me. And then he just goes through each of the individual songs.
And it does, you know, follow the same template. So in the same way that Please Please Me kicks off with I Saw Her Standing There, which is a kind of just instant classic rock and roll song. This album kicks off with It Won't Be Long, or as Tony Barrow writes, It Won't Be Long
Now. He also talks about the debut of a certain George Harrison as a songwriter.
Yes, I like this. I'm going to read the whole paragraph.
Okay, then go on.
Team George. Don't Bother Me marks the disc debut of George Harrison as a composer. It is a fairly fast number with a haunting theme tune. Behind George's double track voice, the rest of the fabulous foursome, he's very big on alliteration, isn't he? Create some unusual instrumental effects. Paul beats out a lean, hollow-boned rhythm from the claves. John uses a tambourine and Ringo hits out a loose-skinned Arabian bongo. Brackets. Don't ask me where he picked that up! Exclamation mark. Brackets. To pound out the onbeat percussive drive. Again, very much of its time.
Arabian bongo. That's a genre I quite like. And Ringo does play the bongos as well, also on Until There Was You. Yeah, it's a bit... what would you say? It's a bit factual, but not pedestrian is unfair.
No, it's factual. It's just the facts, man. The facts.
You know, he ends the notes by saying, you know, money makes a completely worthy climax to this knockout program. Hope it doesn't leave you too breathless to flip back to side one for a repeat play session with the Beatles.
With the Beatles.
See what he did there? He mentioned the title in the thing.
Yeah, can I read my favourite line?
Go on,
he said,
then.
Paul issues forth with the invitation, hold me tight, on the fairly brisk second track of side two. That's as much as he can say about hold me tight. We'll maybe come on to this at some point, but fairly brisk. How would you describe this track? Fairly brisk.
Well, it's not as good as Hold Me Tight from Red Rose Speedway.
No. We'd come on to that as well.
Which is my favourite mistake in the archive collection. I know I've talked about this before.
It's like being in a room with
me,
Owen Paul.
My favourite waste of time.
Oh, is that what it was? We just cut that whole thing.
Okay, then. Fine. So yes, November the 22nd, this long-awaited album is coming out. JFK's assassination will take over the news stories for the foreseeable future. But the tour is still going on, and they're playing in Stockton-on-Tees. And the show must go on.
The show must go on. So, Newcastle.
Hmm.
They get reviews in Newcastle.
Yeah, now this is, it's nice to see, well, not nice to see, but it's, you know, not all reviews have to be glowing, shining, excited for the Beatle reviews.
No, whoever's writing the music column for the Journal in Newcastle, definitely finger on the pulse. I have never attended the mass torture and execution of farmyard animals. He should get out more. But I imagine the noise they would make would be very similar. Thank you, whoever you are.
Well, he's obviously the antimatter Derek Taylor.
Yeah.
That.
Thank you, curmudgeons everywhere.
He's maybe still shell-shocked. Yeah, not much love from the newspapers in Newcastle. Then the 24th, they're at the ABC Cinema in Hull. And then the 25th, they're having another break.
Another day off?
Not really.
No?
No.
Relaxing by the pool?
No. What are they doing?
They, Granada Television Studios in Manchester, to film a performance and interview for the programme Late Scene Extra and Scene at 6:30. We should bring back television programmes called Late Scene Extra and Scene at 6:30. And we should have them fronted by Gay Byrne.
Gay Byrne, Irish. Is it the Irish Johnny Carson? I don't know. Not really.
No. But this is the point where they ask Gay Byrne to be...
Their manager. Yeah.
Because they didn't have a manager.
Yeah, this is... I think they were winding up Gay Byrne.
Or Gay Byrne was winding us up.
Well, I do like the fact that the spirit of these shows lives on with, I think, like the one show on BBC One.
Yes.
If listeners in a certain geographical region will be aware of the one show, there's a fantastic clip of Mel Brooks on the one show. It's this magazine programme that goes out on the BBC at 7 p.m. most evenings, and it basically has back-to-back stories that don't necessarily have any relationship with each other. And you've seen the Mel Brooks clip?
I've seen the Mel Brooks is the two favourite things. One in Mel Brooks. The other, I think, is Sarah Millican, who makes an appearance.
All right.
But Mel Brooks is hilarious.
Basically, they tip from a Mel Brooks interview into some very banal, depressing story.
A duck up a tree.
Yeah. And Mel Brooks just screams, what kind of show is this? Very funny.
Sarah Millican?
Yes.
She's interviewing them, the presenters, and she said, you know, it's amazing. You're on 30 minutes every night. And they say 30 minutes every night and an hour on Wednesday. And she said, what is Wednesday? Just like the big day for shit news?
Yes, and it is live, so they can't really bleep that kind of thing. Yes, so they're doing this local kind of lightweight fare. Granada Television is good to the Beatles in the early days.
Granada Television is very good to the Beatles, and we're sort of, you know, mocking. We're not really mocking Granada, we're mocking Gay Byrne. Well, I'm mocking Gay Byrne. You can't mock Gay Byrne. It's in the Constitution.
He's a national figure.
But yeah, Granada is very good to them. And here what they're doing is that their upcoming single, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and This Boy, the B-side, they film basically a mimed performance. Fun fact. Give the fun fact.
Well, this is there's the famous bit of footage where George in the mid-70s is in Granada with Anthony Wilson and he's looking at old cine tape, and it's this performance of This Boy that's recorded on this day is the film that he is looking at. So this is the day it is recorded.
Yeah, and I mean, this is George at his most, I suppose, anti-Beatle cynical period, and he's just grinning from ear to ear and kind of going, you know, quite good, you know, they're quite good.
But it's I think when we say Granada TV was good to the Beatles, this is also an example of the Beatles being good back to Granada TV, that, you know, they have a tour break and they're still paying back to their local regional television, because Granada will also kind of cover into Merseyside and into Liverpool, so we'll get seen. And speaking of Liverpudlians, Ken Dodd is also on the show.
Ken Dodd. Ken Dodd. Is he the new Cilla Black?
No, because Ken Dodd is fantastic.
Great.
Ken Dodd is great, and I won't hear a word against the magic of Ken Dodd. And
I concur.
Yeah, fine. We can still mention him every now and then. We don't have to be deeply cynical about everything. Okay, fine. And that's their day off on the 25th of November. There's still a little bit of touring left to be done. The Regal Cinema in Cambridge on the 26th of November. And I quite like that there's a 12-man Vespa scooter squad sent by the police.
I can't imagine. I'm just thinking of those, you know, those kind of acrobatic police displays.
Where there's two guys on the end with their arms out.
And everybody's kind of balanced like a huge triangle pyramid on Vespas. I imagine that must have been
what they were doing.
Yeah.
Yes, that's Cambridge. I don't know, was there any local Cambridge Pink Floyd-y people in the audience? Maybe not. So from the 26th of November at the Regal Cinema in Cambridge, they travel to York. I'm working there. That's a couple of hundred miles. Mm-hmm. On the 27th of November. At this point, they get the announcement that She Loves You has sold over 1 million copies in the UK.
Yes. Hmm. And in celebration, all the lights go out in the theatre.
And the curtains have to be pulled back a la The Muppet Show manually.
Yes. So there was some electrical fault. But clearly, you know, it's a fuse that affects the curtains. Obviously, the amps still work.
But again, in terms of sales, we are looking at hundreds of thousands. We're now into millions of sales.
Yeah.
And She Loves You will be the biggest selling single of all time in British history up to that point until...
Ever.
No, I think it,
ever.
It gets replaced by Mull of Kintyre, Stephen.
Ever.
You should know that. Mull of Kintyre by Paul McCartney?
No, never heard
of
it.
You know that song? It goes like this. Mull of Kintyre. No?
No.
Okay.
Oh, Mull of Kintyre.
It's like Mike Yarwood's theme tune.
Yeah.
So She Loves You has sold over 1 million copies, which is pretty rare. And, you know, it's, again, this whole planning of there's another single on the horizon.
It's just building.
It's just building all the time. The 28th of November, they're at the ABC Cinema in Lincoln. And Ringo, is he well?
He's got earache.
Yeah. So he has to have his ear syringed at the local hospital.
Those are the days. One, when you could get your ear syringed.
Here we go.
And two, there was a local hospital.
Have you ever had your ear syringed?
I have, many times. They don't do it anymore.
I had it done years ago. And,
did you enjoy it?
It's like kind of a hedgehog having his dinner, you know? It's like, you know, it's that kind of thing. I wouldn't recommend it.
Okay. I thought they in the Irish National Health, they actually used a hedgehog
to
remove the wax.
No, although that's interesting. And but this is, once again, Ringo's ailments. He probably had a big tin of beans afterwards to fulfill himself. And after the concert, they went to a hotel near Doncaster. And what happened?
The car was driven being driven so erratically by a chauffeur that upon their arrival, they... got on the phone to Brian, who was back from New York, to say, get us a new driver.
Fire him. And this leads to the 29th of November, 1963. The gig is in Huddersfield, but there's more important stuff going on.
There is. This is the release of their fifth single, I Want to Hold Your Hand.
So we've done an episode on I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Did we?
Yes, we did. And, but it is a maelstrom that they are putting this into. A number one album replacing a number one album, and now we're trying to get to the point of a number one single replacing a number one single.
Yeah, so we had the announcement on the 27th that She Loves You had sold over 1 million copies. I Want to Hold Your Hand has pre-orders of more than 1 million copies in the UK.
Yeah, so this is... they're fighting with themselves at this point.
Yeah.
It's almost like a game to say, how big can we get? Well, we're going to put one thing on top of another thing on top of another thing. And they are in no way taking their foot off the gas. As I said earlier on, they're in no way trying to do a victory lap. This is just it.
Yeah, so within a week, it goes to number one and it pushes She Loves You to number two. So they're number one and number two in both the album and the single charts in the UK. So they've arrived.
Mm-hmm. They've locked. But not only have they arrived, again, we point out there is no precedent for this type of arrival, this type of behaviour, this type of success.
This is the point at which time they are outgrowing the constraints of show business in the United Kingdom. Mm. It just can't contain this phenomenon. I mean, it's clear at this point that they're going to go to America and, you know, whilst no British group or no British performer has really conquered America, you've got to think Epstein must have been pretty confident.
Mm.
You know, this is unprecedented in the UK. The US media are already taking an interest. They're primed, ready to go.
And the other thing that the Beatles would know about this is that there is a movie coming. So the Beatles are very confident that beyond the tour, they are going to Paris, they're going to America, they are going to be making a movie. The paperwork is in place for that as well. And at the Irish gigs, they are meeting with their screenwriter and they're starting to assemble what A Hard Day's Night will be like. So they know what's coming next, even if maybe nobody else knows what's coming next.
Yeah. The cinemas that they're playing, they're all the ABC cinemas.
Yeah.
What about the people that want to go and see films?
That is so true.
You know?
Well, the other thing is that on the 29th of November 1963, there's a small mention in a Liverpool newspaper.
There is startling press announcement in the Huyton. We got told off for saying Huyton.
Oh, Huyton, it's Huyton, is it?
The Huyton and Prescott Courier carries an advert placed by Mr. and Mrs. Jameson confirming that, contrary to local rumours, their 18-year-old daughter, Elva, will not be marrying Ringo Starr.
Oh.
There's probably a play there or a drama. I mean, what's the story behind that? You think that's like Elva, 18 years old, is telling people she's going out with Ringo, she's going to marry Ringo?
Well, did Ringo know this person, maybe?
Let's put that. We don't really have a list of questions for Ringo. We have lots of questions, so we'll just write that down.
Does
question number one, Ringo, did you know Elva
Jameson,
and if so, in what capacity? Okay.
And so we get to the end of the magnificent November 1963. They go to the Empire Theatre in Sunderland, and they've played there before.
They had, and I think this is the measure of what has happened across 1963. So they had previously played there on the 9th of February 1963 on the bottom of the bill of a tour headlined by Helen Shapiro.
And this is the whole point, that from the 1st of November to the 30th of November, there are all these kind of moments going off. And we should point out that the tour does continue on.
It does. It continues on until the 13th of December 1963. But that's a whole different episode.
That's a whole different month. Yes, so they finish their tour, they do their London residency, they go to Paris, they go to America, and it all takes off. But the premise that from the very start a Beatles month can contain more activity than most groups' years is kind of contained in all of this. And we also kind of see in the wider sense, you know, there's a global change as well from events that happen in Dallas.
I think it's completely transformational in the UK. And I think, you know, the assassination of Kennedy, that is obviously a factor that comes into play. We talked about this on the Ed Sullivan episodes. But this month is completely transformational. They go from what is possibly seen as a short-term flash in the pan pop group phenomenon. Even they are making plans to do things, you know, may last a year or two. They're absolutely now embedded in UK culture. You know, they're playing these gigs, 120,000 people. They've 20 million people have seen them on TV. They've been greeted by royalty, which is hugely impressive in America. You know, Ed Sullivan will kind of mention this, you know. So they absolutely are established as permanent residents on the charts and a fixture on British front pages of newspapers.
And so we all know what happens next, but I guess the point we're trying to make is to be back in the eye of that storm. You know, Brian knew what was happening next. The four of them knew what was happening next, but they also didn't know what was happening next in some ways. It's not like they'd written the songs for A Hard Day's Night or any of those kind of things. There's still a lot riding on their talent.
Yeah, I think regardless of the fact that we're saying, you know, this is a fantastic strategy, this is brilliantly thought out, there are elements of good luck, of coincidence, of circumstance pushing them forward. And they know they're going to go to America, but arguably they don't have time to think about it. You know, it's as you say, the amount of things that happen in November, they don't have, even on a day off, it isn't a day off. They're still pushing forward, and there's no long-term planning. I think they're just moving from stage to stage.
Yeah. But what do you think, everybody? November 63, is it the most pivotal in-out period in Beatle history from the 1st to the 30th? There's a lot of changes there. We remain available in all the usual places. www.nothingisrealpod.com is the website and your portal to all the stuff. The Facebook Nothing Is Real group. Our communications on X, Instagram and Mastodon and TikTok. And we're always happy to hear from you. We want to thank all our Acast Plus subscribers. There's a whole world of Acast Plus episodes for Nothing Is Real supporters. Again, go to www.nothingisrealpod.com for more information. But for now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And you've been listening to Nothing Is Real.
Bought by Sun Express.
Summer Express. Blau Express. Strand Express. Sun Express. Lecker Express. Chill Express. Mit Sun Express günstig in den Urlaub fliegen. Türkei schon ab 59,99 €. Jetzt buchen auf sunexpress.com.